Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that is made all the richer by the inclusion of our resident law professor, Mary Pat. I make that point this week especially because women and their stories are central to the three films that we will be discussing. One is Rebecca, the latest adaptation of Daphne du Maurier's 1938 novel, followed by two films written and directed by women, Miranda July's Cajillionaire and Sofia Coppola's On the Rocks. Let's begin this week's show by looking at the latest version of a classic novel. Among the numerous adaptations of Daphne du Maurier's novel Rebecca on stage, screen, and television, perhaps the best known is Alfred Hitchcock's 1940 feature film that stars Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier. Though Hitchcock was forced to change du Maurier's novel to abide by the strict dictates of the Hays Code, his version, at least, felt true to its mid-1930s setting. In attempting to update the novel and casting Lily James and Armie Hammer, respectively, in the roles played by Fontaine and Olivier, director Ben Wheatley is in some ways truer to du Maurier's story while failing to capture her intent. James plays the novel's unnamed and naive protagonist, who gets swept away by the dashing Maxim de Winter, played by Hammer, marries him impulsively, then struggles to find her way into or even around his vast Cornwall estate, which is both run by the devious housekeeper Mrs. Danvers, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, and haunted by de Winter's late first wife, for whom the novel and the movie are named. While James continues to impress with her choices of roles, Hammer again dutifully fills the role of the handsome suitor, and Scott Thomas is suitably duplicitous. Wheatley, working from a team-written screenplay, turns du Maurier's tortured study of desire and revenge into ultimately a kind of dark romance. But if du Maurier was anything, she was certainly not a romantic.
Dan, you pretty much captured, given us a capsule review of the film itself. So now we're left with how do we discuss this in a way that critiques the film, but at the same time doesn't sort of trip into the temptation.
Yeah.
Well, there's spoiler territory, and also there's the temptation to just make fun of it. Because I think we've seen that a lot is out there making fun by critics of various sorts, and, you know, not calling it a remake, but rather a remistake or something along those lines. But let's talk about it as a film and what's good and what's bad about this film. And I think we'll find some of each. First of all, it's visually beautiful, which of course is also a problem because it flies in the face of what we think of as the original story Rebecca and then the Hitchcock movie Rebecca, because it should have this sense of sort of foreboding and uncertainty. And instead, it's filled with all these beautiful, bright colors and European venues and beaches and overlooks and so forth. And so I think that that's beautiful, but it does not in any way stay true to what I think of as the story that du Maurier intended to tell. So that's, again, good and bad. The performances, of course, I would watch Armie Hammer do almost anything because he's nice to look at. So much like the film, he captures the screen, he captures our attention, but he doesn't have that sort of sense of, you know, menace that we associate with this particular character. And then we have Lily James, again, same thing, trying to hold her own here, but her naivete is, it's too much to deal with in the beginning. And then we're trying to sort out, you know, what their relationship is really like. Of course, we have Kristen Scott Thomas, who is playing Mrs. Danvers, who, of course, is the center or the heart of the movie. She almost is too over the top in terms of her presence, and it just seems incongruous and at odds with what else is going on. So I will give it to each of you to weigh in on what you found to be the good, the bad, and the ugly, because this film probably is one of those, quote, remakes that did not need to happen.
Yeah, I'm not the first person to point out the irony of 2020 Rebecca being haunted by an earlier, better version of itself, because that's what we have here. And I made the mistake of rewatching the Hitchcock version a couple days before I saw this. And so all of the problems of this movie were even more, you know, laid even barer. And I think that even if I hadn't seen the Hitchcock version, even if that didn't exist, I still would have been really bored by this, because even not having seen that previous incarnation, you can just tell that this material needs to be, as you said, Mary Pat, it needs to be shadowy and it needs to be suspenseful and it needs to have this sense of dread and urgency. And there's none of it here, just because of the way that it's photographed. Manderley itself is supposed to be, you know, a menacing place. And it actually looks like a pretty nice place to live in this movie. Like, it doesn't have any character to it. And Rebecca herself is supposed to be the main character of the film, even though she never physically shows up. She is in every scene of this movie because she's haunting our main character. And yet Lily James in this movie never really seems all that bothered by the fact that everyone keeps talking about Rebecca. She just has this emotional remove from everything. And then there's Armie Hammer, who I think is horrible in this. I mean, I've defended him in other movies, but I just think he's horribly miscast here. I mean, Maxim de Winters is supposed to be brooding. He's supposed to be like mischievous, even though he's handsome and debonair. And Hammer just doesn't have any of those qualities. I mean, I guess Kristen Scott Thomas is the best thing in this. I mean, obviously she's not going to eclipse Judith Anderson as the original Mrs. Danvers, but she does a pretty good job. And I think, you know, she's bringing a different spin to the role that still works. But yeah, I don't really know why anyone wanted to make this. Ben Wheatley is an interesting director, but I don't see any of his strengths showing up in this movie. I mean, it's crazy how you can take the exact same material that made a great film and follow it pretty closely. I mean, as you alluded to, there are changes made to this Rebecca from the old one. And a lot of it has to do with the time in which they were each made. But it's crazy that you can take the same material and make a great film and a mostly worthless film, I think. I really hated this. I kind of resented it after a while because it was taking such a good story and turning it into nothing, really.
Yeah, I did talk about spoilers at the beginning, and you know, it's really difficult to talk about this new version of Rebecca without kind of addressing those, because the screenwriters do hew closer to what Du Maurier put on the page, and it involves the demise of Rebecca the years before. Yet we don't want to be too specific, because you know, some people, they're coming to this new, this whole material new. So we want to let people see it and make up their own minds. But by changing it back to the original one, they bring up a whole notion of guilt and innocence that they never really deal with. And to a modern sensibility, it's like, what? Are you serious?
Well, and I think we should talk about the spoilers, because after these glowing reviews, don't you think people will just not want to see it at all? Not want to spend even one penny on it?
Well, let's just say this, that when you murder someone, I don't care if they ask for it, it's not a good thing.
Okay. Well, I think there would be a way to update this into even a contemporary setting. You'd have to change quite a bit. But I think you could still make an interesting Rebecca remake. This isn't it. And I wish the original one was streaming. I have the Criterion Blu-ray, and it looks great. So if you can get your hands on that, check that out.
Well, everybody, let's just head to Nathan's house and we can watch.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, sounds good.
That was our review of the Netflix remake of Daphne du Maurier's 1938 novel, Rebecca. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Kajillionaire and On the Rocks. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Netflix remake of Daphne du Maurier's novel, Rebecca. Let's now move to Cajillionaire and On the Rocks. Let's begin with another Miranda July study in quirk. I say quirk because July makes films that, while mostly studies of people trying to connect with others as well as with themselves, she does so in ways that at times appear just a bit cute. Case in point, Cajillionaire, which we stream through Amazon Prime, involves four characters, three of whom are a loosely knit family. Robert, played by Richard Jenkins, Teresa, played by an almost unrecognizable Deborah Winger, and wait for it, their daughter, Old Dolio, played by Evan Rachel Wood. A trio of huckster scam artists, the three meet up with Melanie, played by Gina Rodriguez, while on one of their potential scams, and her presence slowly begins to break down the familiar bonds. What Cajillionaire ends up being is a tender coming of age, or perhaps coming of consciousness, story for Old Dolio. And while each member of the cast is good, it's Rachel Wood, buried under a horrendous wig, who impresses the most by affecting a vulnerable character, unlike the Ice Maiden she has played in films such as 13, Running with Scissors, or the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce. As for quirk, I have one word for you: bubbles.
You mentioned the word cute in your intro, Dan, and I want to address that because Miranda July, she's made three films now. Me and You and Everyone We Know was her debut. She followed that up with The Future and now Cajillionaire. She's one of those filmmakers who, if she's not your cup of tea, she is really not your cup of tea. You probably find her movies unbearably quirky and, yes, maybe a little cute. But if you're a fan of her work, which I tend to be, at least these three films that she's made, you really appreciate the way that she looks at the world. She has this really cockeyed kind of view of humanity and societal norms. And she comes up with these scenes, especially in Me and You and Everyone We Know, which I think is still probably her best film, that are almost like these self-contained little short films unto themselves. And Cajillionaire is filled with those, with these unusual but really memorable images. I mean, even just the way that these characters look with their long hair and their oversized, outdated thrift store clothes, you kind of wonder where they're from, what planet they're from even. And you mentioned the bubbles, which, to explain that, they live in this office building that's attached to a bubble factory. And a couple times a day, this wall of bubbles just comes down from the ceiling and they have to scoop them up and dump them into a drain or else the foundation of the building will crumble. And just that image is so kind of eerie and funny. And then there's that scene where they pretend to be that terminally ill man's family and make noise in the other room so he can hear them. And it gives him the illusion of having a family again. There are all of these little moments in Cajillionaire that worked really well for me, even though for most of the running time, I was not totally sure what July was up to and what she was trying to say. And then there's a moment, it's a literal earth-shaking moment that happens about two-thirds of the way through this movie, and it kind of clicked for me. And I got what she was going for, and I understood what the message of this film is. And then it really worked for me. So I liked this a lot. I'm still thinking about it. I would actually like to go back and watch it again before I put together my year-end top 10 list. Right now, I don't know if it would quite make it, but maybe a second viewing, I would appreciate it a lot more and it would kind of work its way up there. But for me, this worked. I don't know about you guys. I'll be curious to see what you think.
I liked much about this film, but when you use the sort of terminology, did it work? I don't know if I can buy into that completely because, Nathan, as you indicated, it does feel almost like a series of vignettes, which is, I think, a hallmark of her filmmaking, and that's okay. And you're correct that at some point it needs to be brought together. And I think she does ultimately do that successfully, but it was a little bit of a slog to get there. And so you seemed a little bit more open to the opportunity of waiting for that sort of aha moment, because we do discover maybe in the end, you know, this is a story about family. It is a story about connection. It is a story. It's like a Arrested Development coming of age story in large part. And so once the pieces sort of fall into place, it does make sense. I guess I like quirky, and this is certainly quirky, as Dan called it up front. But I also, if I'm going to be involved in a movie such as this, I would have appreciated knowing exactly what the underlying premise was, maybe a little earlier, so I could just sit back and enjoy it rather than waiting for maybe what was to come next, or if this was going to take a sudden turn in a really strange direction. Because that's that sense of not foreboding, but that sense of sort of low-level anxiety that I felt throughout. But I have to say, Evan Rachel Wood, regardless of what you have thought about her other performances going way back to her teen years and her sort of lifestyle that ends up in the tabloids and at various times, I mean, she is amazing with the way that, you know, she looks in this movie. So her physicality in terms of being dwarfed by these huge clothing, and then she performs these acrobatic stunts and so forth. Amazing.
Yeah. The two things I wanted to say was, I want to defend my use of the word quirk. I mean it as a warning for people. This is going to be a strange little movie if you're not used to Miranda July. Her first film was one of my favorite films of that year. So I really am a fan of hers. The second thing is, my point about Evan Rachel Wood is that I judge actors by their ability to completely create a new character. And that's what she does here. She is nothing like anything she's ever done before. And I was impressed by that. So there are really a lot of things I liked about Kajillionaire. I wasn't the best of what Miranda July have done, in my opinion. At any rate, that was Kajillionaire. Let's close with On the Rocks. Sofia Coppola long ago became more than Francis Ford Coppola's daughter. And whether we're talking about 2003's Lost in Translation, 2006's Marie Antoinette, or 2013's The Bling Ring, among others, Coppola always puts a woman's experience at the center of what she's exploring. That's certainly the case with On the Rocks, which we stream through Apple TV Plus, and which is less about a marriage facing potential problems than it is about a woman coming to grips with her mixed emotions concerning her charismatic, seemingly carefree father. Rashida Jones plays Laura, a writer approaching 40, who, though happily married to workaholic Dean, played by Marlon Wayans, and the mother of two ultra-cute little girls, is floundering professionally. Worse, she's beginning to suspect that Dean is having an affair. Enter Dad Felix, played by none other than Bill Murray, whose worldview is shaped by his own penchant for womanizing, and soon the two are on a mission to see if Laura's suspicions are true. Like Lost in Translation, in which Murray stars as a man who helps Scarlett Johansson's character find a sense of self, On the Rocks is a study of Laura's search for meaning, only in this case, Murray's character is less a tutor than a foil who inspires Laura's own acceptance of her roles as a daughter, as a wife, and mother, but most of all, as an adult woman with a clear-eyed view of who and what she is.
It is intriguing to me that you use the term foil in the way that you did, Dan, here, because I think many people would characterize Rashida Jones and her performance as playing the foil to Bill Murray, because he takes over this film. And so that's one of my issues, I think, here, is the fact that you're correct. This is a woman-centered film, but he sort of eclipses everything that you see happening around you. And there is much to like about this film, but from my perspective, all I kept thinking was Woody Allen, Woody Allen, Woody Allen. And the other problem, of course, is the fact that it's New York setting, of course, which conjured up those relationships or that thought of Woody Allen, you know, looks beautiful. And you're just, oh, I wish I could be there. I wish I could just walk down one street for, you know, 5 minutes during this time period. So I was pulled out of this at various points. In the end, however, On the Rocks, I think it's definitely the type of movie that people would enjoy during this time period, but it doesn't quite work. I don't think it's Lost in Translation, which I do still feel is her best film. And I think that the Bill Murray character, I mean, of course, we're always wondering, so is this commentary on the father-daughter relationship that Sofia Coppola has experienced herself? I don't know. But didn't quite work for me. Things I liked about it, nonetheless.
Yeah, I think that this is a showcase for the Bill Murray performance. And there are two great scenes in this movie. One, where he smooth talks his way out of a parking ticket.
Yeah.
Like he almost pirouettes around the possibility of getting a parking ticket. And it almost feels like this is, it's all of the myths that we've heard about the real Bill Murray in one scene. And then there's another one where he recounts the dissolution of his own marriage right. and the affair that caused it. And then the dissolution of that affair. That I think are really good. I'm sure he's like a shoe-in for end of the year awards for this. My problem with it though, is I was really disappointed with the screenplay, which is usually the
highlight.
Yeah, the highlight of Coppola's films, because this is basically a Three's Company episode with Rashida Jones and Bill Murray like ducking behind potted plants and hiding, you know, running down alleyways to hide. And you just kind of wish that she would just have that conversation, ask that question, and then everything would be over with, you know, like adults do. So the plot is basically just an excuse for these two actors to work together and have kind of like a caper plot. But yeah, I was disappointed by the story here, even though I think and Rashida Jones is very good too. But yeah, I wish I liked this more because I expect more from Sofia Coppola.
You know, I agree with both of you. I think that what saves the movie for me is that there is no third act twist. There is no huge moment, emotional moment. That it is a movie in which the Rashida Jones's character comes to some sense of herself separate from her father, who, wouldn't we all love to have a father like this? And wouldn't we all get lost in his worldview? On one hand, we'd go, yeah. And then on the other hand, we'd go, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense at all. So there was...
What a nice guy misogynist.
Yes, exactly. And let's face it, if you're going to make a movie like this, who else would you cast but Bill Murray? I mean, it is a perfect role for him. So I was kind of in between both of you with this. On the Rock certainly isn't Sofia Coppola's best movie, but I think that it still is worth seeing. So... And that was On the Rocks, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed Rebecca and Kajillionaire. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. And until then, remember these words from Daphne du Maurier's novel, Rebecca. Happiness is not a possession to be prized. It is a quality of thought, a state of mind. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.